Thank you. I'll talk in general about the problem of thermal conduction in turbulent magnetized plasmas and focus on an application of this topic to galaxy cluster plasma, and in particular one model of galaxy cluster plasma, the cooling flow model. I'll spend most of my time discussing the phenomenology of thermal conduction in turbulent magnetic fields, and then, time permitting at the end, discuss some analytic and numerical results. My collaborators on this work are Steve Cowley, Brian Albright, and Rick Sidora. So to start, some words on galaxy clusters. These are some of the largest organized structures observed in the universe. They typically contain a few hundred to a couple thousand galaxies. This is a picture of the central region of the Perseus cluster. The arc minute in this picture corresponds to about 15 to 30 kiloparsecs. So this region is about 150 kiloparsecs perhaps across, 100, 150 kiloparsecs across. The cluster as a whole has a radius of about a megaparsec. So this is a picture of the central region of this cluster. The color contours in this picture are X-ray emission, and the X-ray emission is evidence of diffuse hot gas filling the space between galaxies in these clusters. The gas can be very hot, temperatures up to 10 to the 8th degrees Kelvin, tends to be quite diffuse as well. Let me, for reference, list some of the typical parameters one has for galaxy clusters. The radius, typical radius about a megaparsec. Masses, overall cluster masses ranging from 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 solar masses typically. Of the total mass, about 10% is in the form of that hot gas. That's to be compared with the stars in the galaxies, which comprise about only 1% of the cluster's total mass. So the dominant form of baryons in a cluster is typically this hot gas. High temperatures, densities. Well, the temperatures tend to be cooler near the center of a cluster, hotter in the outerlying area regions. The density ranges from about 10 to the minus 2 particles per cubic centimeter near the center of a cluster, getting less dense, 10 to the minus 4 particles per cubic centimeter towards the outer regions of a cluster. And this parameter lambda is the collisional mean free path of the thermal particles. It can be of order 1 kiloparsec in a cluster core, getting much larger towards the edge of a cluster. One can calculate a radiative cooling time for this gas, the time required for the gas to radiate away its thermal energy through Bremsstrahlung radiation. This depends upon the density and temperature of the gas. And in a majority of clusters, 70 to 80% of clusters, that cooling time, tau cool, at the center of the cluster is shorter than the Hubble time, which implies that cooling is playing an important role in many clusters. This observation inspires one of the leading models for galaxy cluster gas, namely the cooling flow model. This is a steady state, quasi-steady state model of this hot plasma. And the basic idea is pretty simple. Imagine taking a spherical shell centered on the center of the cluster, and calculate the amount of energy you lose from within that shell due to this Bremsstrahlung radiation. In a rough steady state, the energy that you lose will be balanced by an inflow of energy from larger radii. More precisely, you balance the net energy that you lose against the thermal energy you convect in, the PdV work and the gravitational work. And this gives you an estimate of the radial velocity. Once you get the density of the cluster, this gives you a mass accretion rate. And the mass accretion rates can be very high in clusters, up to 1,000 solar masses per year. If you integrate those mass accretion rates over a 10 to the 10 year lifetime, you conclude that you can have very large amounts of mass accreting in these systems, up to 10 to the 13 solar masses. A critical assumption in this model is that there's no heating in this central region, or that the heating is simply very small compared to the net cooling. And I'll come back to that assumption in a little while. There are a number of observations supporting this model. As I mentioned before, the X-ray observations give you temperature and density profiles, which give you cooling times shorter than the Hubble time in many clusters. There's evidence of cold gas from X-ray line and continuum absorption. There's also evidence of gas at temperatures of around 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin, which may be gas that has cooled out of the hot phase and is on its way to colder temperatures yet. Also, the spectra of some of the CD galaxies at the centers of clusters seem consistent with ongoing low-mass star formation. On the other hand, there are a number of observations which are not consistent with this model. The radio observations of clusters can put upper limits on the amount of cooled gas, both in atomic and molecular form. The upper limits you find are typically smaller than the amounts of mass that are inferred from the X-ray observations. So there's a contradiction between these radio observations and the X-ray observations. Also, UV observations give you upper limits on the amount of mass that's being converted to stars with a standard initial mass function. And basically, you can't be converting large amounts of mass on the order of the types of mass accretion rates that people quote from the cooling flow model. You can't convert that much mass into stars with the standard IMF. So there's a discrepancy here between the X-ray observations on the one hand and then radio and UV on the other. You could resolve this discrepancy if the mass that you're accreting is going into very low-mass stars or very low-mass compact objects. But that's not a very satisfying resolution to the discrepancy because you can't easily go out and observe these objects. Because of that, because the observations are going to have a hard time resolving this discrepancy, it's important to go back and look as carefully as you can at this key assumption in the cooling flow model, namely that there's no heating in this central region. One way of explaining the radio and UV observations would be to reduce the inflow that you require to balance the energy that you're losing in this central region by supplying heat from some source. If you had a heat that, say, heating that balanced 90% of your cooling, you could reduce the inflow rates by about 90%, which would be good from the point of view of explaining some of the observations. The X-rays, X-ray emission, there is some, and that's some of the, has been used to suggest that there's cold mass present in some of these clusters. One of the potentially important heating sources for that central gas is thermal conduction. If the thermal conduction in this galaxy cluster plasma proceeds at the Spitzer rate, kappa T is what I'll use for the thermal conductivity. If that's comparable to kappa S, the Spitzer conductivity for a non-magnetized gas, then you can have very rapid conductive heating of the central region. Heat can be conducted in from the outer, hotter regions into this cooler central region. And the time to reheat the central region by conduction can be smaller than the cooling time. If the thermal conductivity is a Spitzer conductivity, in general, this conduction time will be smaller than the cooling time, and you wouldn't have a cooling flow at all. You'd have something more like a heating flow, an outflow. The heating of the central gas would drive an expansion. And this fact has led some people to wonder, can you suppress thermal conductivity in galaxy clusters? And one of the things that has been proposed is a mechanism for suppressing thermal conductivity to keep the cooling flow model consistent is magnetic fields in clusters. Magnetic fields are observed in clusters through Faraday rotation and synchrotron radiation measurements, field strengths ranging from a microgauss up to 100 microgauss. You can estimate a field scale length from Faraday rotation measurements. This is a very inexact science. The estimates range from about 1 to 40 kiloparsecs, scales which are much smaller than the size of a cluster or even of a cluster core, which might be 100 or 200 kiloparsecs in radius. Because LB, the field scale length, is smaller than the cluster core size, this field is sometimes referred to as a tangled magnetic field. And so the question becomes, how does heat get conducted in a system with a tangled magnetic field? And that's what I'll talk about in this. Sure. From which part of the cluster?
Well, I don't remember the data at all well, but if you look at the cluster, you know, it's pretty strong synchrotron radiation, it's
right.
Pretty deep into the central regions, and it's not a uniform field, it's not 70% polarized.
Right.
And 50% polarized. which if I took LZ, meaning a true randomization of N scale,
right. I think one way, maybe, if you have the radiation source concentrated in a particular region, then you might have not have so many reversals from that one region. That could give you some.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. Yes, there is some evidence of turbulence in these clusters. You can look at the line widths of the optical line-emitting gas at about 10 to the 4 degrees Kelvin, and there's some indication that you have turbulence speeds of order 100 kilometers to second or 200. Yes, that, well, you're thinking of, say, turbulent diffusion. That can indeed play a role. Actually, it will turn out that that is normally less than the electron heat transport for these systems where you have such large collisional mean free paths. But that is something that would have to be considered.
Yeah. It also turns out that the simulations that I did with Mario Livio and Chris O'Day, that it's impossible to have galaxies flowing through the clusters without setting up large scale.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense. I guess that becomes a little bit less efficient once the galaxies become stripped, but to some extent, the galaxies certainly generate turbulence. Other possibilities for generating turbulence is not individual galaxies, but large-scale gravitational interactions generating turbulence on very large scales, which then breaks up into smaller-scale motions. This magnetic field may well be associated with this turbulence just through some kind of small-scale dynamo, which generates this field. Okay. This is, again, not an exact science. Let's see, I brought one picture, which I wasn't going to show. This is a picture, this is actually not even, this may be a little bit misleading. This is a picture of a radio source. Where is it taken? The Centaurus cluster. This is a picture of rotation measures towards different parts of this radio source. And blue in this picture indicates one sign of rotation measure, red another sign. And you can see that that rotation measure varies across this source. That indicates the field cannot be uniform over those distances. You can also look at background radio sources. This, you don't really know, is this Faraday rotation from the cluster field or is it from a field intrinsic to that radio source, but there is a consensus, at least, that the field in the cluster at large is tangled. Let's see. Get back to my... Okay, so how does a tangled magnetic field affect thermal conduction? Well, there are a few possibilities. A number of people have looked at this problem. One possibility that has been proposed is that tangled magnetic fields don't affect the conductivity significantly. This would lead to heating flow, an outflow, no cooling flow. Another possibility is that the thermal conductivity, kappa T, is reduced relative to the Spitzer value for a non-magnetized gas, kappa S, by a small factor, maybe on the order of 10. This would still allow you to have some cooling, but it would be at a rate that's much less than in the cooling flow model. So you could reduce your mass accretion rates for those moderate reductions in the thermal conductivity. Another possibility is that you reduce the thermal conductivity by a very large factor. If you can reduce it by a factor of over 100, you can safely ignore thermal conduction in many of these cooling flows and get very large mass accretion rates. What I'm going to do in the rest of this talk is argue for either one of these two possibilities here. The previous studies of this problem, there have been several, and they've applied an incorrect phenomenology of turbulent of electron heat transport in a turbulent magnetic field. The correct phenomenology was discovered in the 70s in the fusion community, and that's what I'm going to describe in the rest of this talk. To get started, let me... start with a simpler example than thermal conduction in a tangled magnetic field, simply thermal conduction in a non-magnetized gas. It's basically, if you ignore turbulent transport for the time being, it's basically spatial diffusion of electrons from hot regions to cold regions. I say electrons because they move faster than the protons and they dominate the heat transport. Electron in a collisional plasma is undergoing many small angle collisions continuously, but it's simpler to think of an electron as undergoing large angle collisions separated by a time interval, in which case the electron's motion through space is a random walk path of length, the collisional mean free path, you can get the thermal conductivity by approximating it to be equal to the spatial diffusion coefficient of the electrons. The time to take one of these random steps is just the mean free path divided by the thermal speed. This gives you a spatial diffusion coefficient delta x squared over delta t of v thermal times lambda. And that is roughly the Spitzer thermal conductivity for a non-magnetized gas. And you want to do... Yes?
I'm very troubled by what you just said.
Okay. Yes.
Of course, eventually you can be wrong, but I mean, you say, what makes you say that, this is an equivalent way to look at it?
For, you mean the equivalent to looking at the case with the tangled magnetic field?
No, with the non-magnetic case,
yes.
The electrons have small angle scattering.
Right.
You say it's just its equivalent.
Oh.
Saying that this is the...
Okay, I don't want to say it's equivalent. This is something which simplifies one's understanding of it. It turns out that this gives you a... Okay. You're absolutely right that you would not want to say that the actual process is equivalent to infrequent large angle collisions. You're absolutely right. You would want to do the kinetic theory precisely. I'm introducing this kind of view graph. I'll show another one in a couple minutes, just for the point of view of explaining the ideas. That you have a mean free path, which wouldn't be, you wouldn't travel straight in a line and then scatter, but you'd have a curved trajectory, which will be approximated by this picture. You don't buy it. Why don't you keep that in mind and maybe ask it again as I go further along?
The only thing to do is say if lambda was a negative reflection on it, I'd like to worry about it in
P. Yes. How does this work in a tangled field? Well, let me introduce another simplification, which is valid in the limit that we're going to ignore turbulent diffusion. And I'll come back to turbulent diffusion at the very end of this talk. So here, I'm thinking of the magnetic field as being frozen and not moving. And the reason I'm doing that is because the electrons move much faster than the fluid. In a single temperature plasma, the fluid is actually moving at less than the sound speed, we believe, from the observations of turbulent line widths. The electrons are moving much faster than the sound speed. So you can think of the electrons as zipping along field lines, and the field lines to a lowest approximation being frozen in space. How does an electron move along a frozen field line? Well, the electron gyro radius in a cluster is only about 10 to the 8 centimeters. About 14 orders of magnitude smaller than the field scale length LB. So it's natural to think of the electrons as being tied exactly to a single field line. And that's the approximation that most people have used in studying this problem as it applies to clusters. What do you get if you make that assumption? Well, imagine that we have an electron starting here, moving along a field line in one direction along the field. Even if the field is not moving in space, the electron is basically undergoing a random walk as it moves along this field. And here I've done another one of these things where I'm drawing this field line is sort of disjointed. The field line, in fact, is curved with a scale length LB. I'm just doing this to illustrate its analogy to a random walk. You get a random walk step length of LB. The time it takes to take a random step is LB divided by the thermal speed. The spatial diffusion coefficient of these electrons is delta x squared over delta t, just v thermal times LB. If LB is of order the mean free path of the electrons, which it roughly is in clusters, then you would conclude from this that the thermal conductivity is about equal to the Spitzer value. But there's a critical flaw with this analysis. In particular, the electrons aren't moving in the same direction along this magnetic field. They're still undergoing collisions. That actually reduces their spatial diffusion coefficient a lot. And this is one way you can understand that. Take, again, here a picture of a field line frozen in space. It's like a random walk path. Imagine an electron moves some distance, little l, along a field line. That's equivalent to taking a certain number of random steps, capital N number of random steps, the distance traveled divided by the field scale length, LB. There's a three-dimensional RMS step you take when you take n random steps of length LB, and that's delta R, the RMS displacement, goes like the square root of n times LB squared. So delta R scales as the square root of L. Now, if the parallel displacement is collisional, if it's undergoing collisions, L scales like the square root of time. There'll be some parallel diffusion coefficient describing motion along the field. L scales like the square root of time. Plugging this into this formula, you get that delta R scales like the fourth root of time. Now, for three-dimensional diffusion, you need delta R to scale like the square root of time. That's the characteristic of a diffusive process. In the long time limit, you would have zero diffusion coefficient if the electron were exactly tied to a single field line. Now, that seems like a really extreme statement, no diffusion of electrons. You can understand it from another viewpoint. If you think about an electron moving along the field, undergoing a large angle collision, it then has a 50% chance of turning around and moving right back to its initial point. And that's very much not a random walk. In the three-dimensional random walk, the second step is completely uncorrelated from the first, whereas here, if it's tied to the same field line, it has a 50% chance of returning to its initial point, which basically shuts down the diffusion. It's clear from this that the electron has to get off its initial field line if you're going to get uncorrelated steps. This is the Markov assumption in random walks, that the second step is uncorrelated from the first. Think about a single electron. Ask how it moves. Yes, it is. Speed. Right. The approximation that I'm working in, the approximation I'm working in is thinking of test particles. So think of starting with a hot electron. And one limit in which this is valid. So electron-ion collisions, for example. That would be one limit in which this is valid. You're right, want to put in the electron collisions in your final theory. So it's clear from this, though, that you have to get your electron off of this field line if it's going to have a non-zero diffusion coefficient. And here's one sort of this is one basic idea to keep in mind. Since cross-field motion is very slow, it has to get off its initial field line to diffuse, you expect that the diffusion is going to be quite slow. How does it get off its initial field line? Well, when it undergoes a collision, it can move perpendicular to the field a distance of order the gyro radius, a small perpendicular displacement, 10 to the 8 centimeters. That's almost negligible, and you would want to ignore it, except for the fact that the field is tangled. And in a tangled field, neighboring field lines will diverge from one another. In fact, on average, they'll diverge from each other exponentially. Take, for example, an electron starting on field line A. It undergoes a collision. It moves 10 to the 8 centimeters across the field to field line B. It follows field line B, which is on average exponentiating from field line A, and eventually can get very far from its initial field line. If D of L is the distance between these two field lines, it would increase, at least according to a number of studies, on average exponentially with the distance you move along the field, little l. There's this length in the exponent here, the Kolmogorov-Lyapunov length, which is a subject of some controversy. A number of studies, though, take it to be about equal to the field correlation length. Taking that into account, and there's one other thing I want to introduce in this picture. There's this important length, which I'm denoting L sub RR, after Rechester and Rosenbluth, who were the first to uncover the phenomenology of which I'll describe fully in just a minute. And this length here is the distance an electron must move along the field so that if it started out taking one 10 to the 8 centimeter jump across the field, after moving this distance, the new field line would have exponentiated a distance LB away from the original field line. So that's a parallel distance the electron must move to basically become uncorrelated from its initial field line. For a cluster, that distance LRR is like 30 times LB. It's basically LB times the log of LB over the gyro radius. So putting that together with a picture of a tangled field, you can uncover the following basic phenomenology for spatial diffusion in a tangled field. So you start with an electron at point P in this picture, and it's moving along the It's moving along this field, this solid line here towards point Q. The solid line is a field line. It takes, it undergoes a collision, moves across the field a small distance, starts exponentiating away from its initial field line. After it moves that distance LRR along the field, it reaches this point here, where it's now a distance LB away from its initial field line. It continues along the field and eventually reaches point R. And then its one-dimensional motion along the field reverses. It starts going back across, back along the field, but again it's undergoing small perpendicular displacements across the field. It follows a new field line which diverges from its intermediate path, and then it comes down to point S here. And the key thing about this picture is that by moving a long distance along the field, a distance greater than the Rochester-Rosenbluth length, the electron gets out of this constraint that it has a high likelihood of returning to its initial point. And that's what you require for a three-dimensional diffusive process. The fundamental random walk step in this picture is then taking a step along the field of some multiple of the Rochester-Rosenbluth length. And let me just go through this quickly since it's the central point. You can get the diffusion coefficient in the thermal conductivity pretty quickly just by making this assumption. The fundamental random walk step is taking a step LRR along the field. That means taking a certain number of steps of length LB, a certain number of random steps of length LB. The mean square displacement by taking this number of steps of length LB is just the number of steps times LB squared, written here. What's the time to take that step? It's the square of the parallel distance divided by the parallel diffusion coefficient. Now the thermal conductivity will be the spatial diffusion coefficient of the electrons, just plugging in for delta x squared and delta t. You get that kappa t is d parallel times this reduction factor, LB over LRR. That number might be 1 over 30. This d parallel, if the field strength is constant, d parallel is about v thermal times the collisional mean free path of the Spitzer conductivity. So this will be telling you that the thermal conductivity is reduced by this factor, which captures the effects of tangling, tangled magnetic fields, how that affects spatial diffusion. Another point here is that this LRR, you might want to make that number a bit bigger than LRR in the sense that if the particle moves only a distance LRR along the field from point P up to this point here and then reverses its direction, it will retrace much of its previous path. Not all of it, but much of it. To get the second step to really be uncorrelated from the first, you really want the particle to move two or three times LRR before it reverses direction. And so you might want to make this LRR here in the denominator here a factor of three larger. I don't know. It's a game of guesswork at this point because we don't really know from particle simulations, for example, more quantitatively what coefficients we'd want in front of this equation. But this is half of the story. This is actually the most important half, how tangling affects thermal conduction. You get a reduction of this due to this term here. But there's another part of the way in which you can affect thermal conduction in a cluster, and that's by affecting the parallel motion, affecting this D parallel here. One branch of research into this problem has looked at how large heat fluxes can generate waves which reduce the heat flux. If you have a large heat flux, the electron distribution becomes distorted. There's free energy that can excite Whistler waves, ion acoustic modes. Those modes can scatter the electrons, reducing D parallel. Those effects become important when you have very large temperature gradients, or in other words, when you have very small-scale thermal instabilities in a cluster. They're not so important when you're talking about the cluster as a whole in thermal conduction to the central 100 kiloparsecs or so. Another effect which can be important, depending upon the nature of the field, is magnetic mirrors. If you have an intermittent field strength, you can have magnetic mirrors which can inhibit the flow of particles along the field. It can accelerate them in certain situations as well, yes. That will probably not be critical for a cluster. Let me talk just about their effects on the heat conduction now. The basic idea behind a magnetic mirror, if you have a strong field region and a weak field region, field lines get focused into the strong field region. An electron moving along this central field line here experiences a V cross B force. There's a radial component to B in this region here where the field lines are getting focused. if you think of cylindrical coordinates oriented along a z-axis that's horizontal, the v theta br part of this v cross b force pushes the electron back along the z-axis, reflecting it away from this strong field region. These strong field regions can act like potential barriers. How does that affect thermal conduction and parallel diffusion? Here's a simple example. Plotted in this picture at the top is a simple sinusoidally modulated field strength as a function of distance along a field line, L. Particles can be trapped in magnetic wells, regions between peaks in the field strength. On the bottom here is plotted a phase space, a one-dimensional phase space of particles moving in this magnetic field configuration. The dotted lines here represent particle trajectories in this phase space. L, the horizontal axis, is distance along a field line. The vertical axis is the pitch angle cosine, the parallel speed of the electron divided by its total speed. So it's a cosine of the angle between velocity and the magnetic field. Particles which have a value of c equal to 1 or minus 1, or close to 1 or minus 1, are not reflected by the magnetic mirror. They can pass over the magnetic mirrors, but particles that have smaller values of mod c get trapped, and you have other types of orbits here that are circular and closed. There are two ways in which these mirrors affect the transport. One is if a particle is trapped in a mirror, it doesn't get to diffuse long distances along the magnetic field. The second way in which the mirrors affect the transport is that ordinarily, for a particle to switch directions along the field, it has to scatter by 90 degrees or 180 degrees through Coulomb collisions. In this case, a particle only needs to scatter out of this passing region into the trapped region. It has to scatter just a small angle, which takes less time. So a particle initially moving along the field gets scattered a small angle, becomes a trapped particle, circles along this orbit for a while, and then maybe when it scatters again, it might get kicked back into the passing region down here and travel back along the field. That fact that it only needs to scatter a small angle basically reduces the parallel mean free path of particles, and that reduces the parallel diffusion coefficient. So there are those two ways in which you can inhibit motion along the field. Let me now give you something that's not hand waving. This is an analysis of this effect on parallel diffusion based upon the kinetic equation for the electrons, just the parallel motion of the electrons. F is the electron distribution function, L distance along a field line, this is the pitch angle cosine. This term on the right-hand side here is the Lorentz collision operator. I'm just including electron-ion collisions in this analysis. And you can solve this equation for the electron distribution for different models of the field strength, and that will give you the diffusion coefficient. Here's an example, a simple example, where the field strength is modulated with this sinusoidal perturbation. So the field strength B is B naught times this factor. Alpha is a coefficient between 0 and 1. And in this example, the perhaps unphysical limit is considered in which LB is much less than lambda, which is much less than the temperature gradient scale length LT. Epsilon is a small parameter here. Theta is the fractional reduction in the parallel diffusion coefficient due to these magnetic mirrors. So when theta is 1, the magnetic mirrors have no effect. When theta is 0, you have no diffusion. And you can see in this picture both some analytic results and Monte Carlo particle simulations, which show that as you increase this parameter alpha towards 1, you get a substantial reduction in the parallel diffusion coefficient, which can inhibit heat conduction. A more physically realistic case would be for a random magnetic field. And here are some particle simulation results for a couple distribution functions of random magnetic fields. Again, plotted on the vertical axis is the fractional reduction in diffusivity. There are two suites of particle simulations illustrated here. The diamonds correspond to weak field strength fluctuations. The field strength fluctuations are indicated by this parameter here, average of B squared average divided by mod B average squared. If that number is 1, you have basically a constant field strength. If that number is much larger than 1, you have very strong field strength fluctuations. You can see that by raising the field strength fluctuations, you lower this curve to the x's, and that gives you more inhibition of particle transport. You can also see that as the field scale length is reduced relative to the collisional mean free path, you reduce the diffusion even more, essentially because the parallel mean free path can be reduced to the field scale length, because the particles can get basically scattered into and out of these short magnetic mirrors. Now, you could in clusters, it's not clear in clusters what type of PDF you have for the field strength. Lambda is the actual collisional mean free path. LB is the field scale length. This would be, say, calculated, you could have it for... on the left-hand side of this graph, the mirrors are spaced very close together in comparison to the collisional mean free path. It's very problematic to apply this to clusters, though, because we don't know LB very well. We also don't know the PDF of cluster turbulence. If you had, for example, a lot of self-gravitating clouds in a cluster core where the field strength could be locally enhanced, you could have very strong fluctuations in the field strength and have magnetic mirroring play a very important role. But we don't know that those things are there. They may arise from galaxies being stripped of their clouds, but they may not be there. So it's very dicey to apply this in a quantitative way to clusters at this point. Actually, I'm going to start wrapping up here. Let me put this together. What have basically I been trying to show? The basic phenomenology of electron heat transport in a tangled magnetic field depends upon two different types of processes. One had to do with the parallel motion of particles along the magnetic field. Particles have to go long distances along the magnetic field. Their diffusion along the field can be inhibited by magnetic mirrors, in some cases by small-scale turbulence, but probably not in the case of interest right now, diffusion of heat into a cluster core. The second part of the problem has to do with how electrons can get off of their initial field lines. They have to get off their initial field line, otherwise they are constrained to have a large probability of returning to their initial point. And the reduction due to that constraint in the heat transport is embodied by this LB over LRR factor, which is hard to pin down numerically. Putting both of those factors together, one finds that the thermal conductivity is the Spitzer value times two reduction factors, one due to magnetic mirrors, one due to tangling. Mirrors, this factor is very weakly constrained between no reduction at all and maybe a factor of 10. The tangling factor is between a factor of 30 and perhaps 100, remembering that a particle has to go not just a single distance. Let me put this back up for one more minute. A particle moving just beyond this decorrelation length along the field from P just up to this point here, if it reverses direction, again, it retraces much of its previous displacement. It really needs to go quite farther along the field before it really gets to a second independent random step. So there may be some factors of order unity that haven't been captured in this formula, which is why I put down this lower limit of 0.01 for this reduction factor. Putting those things together, you have a very broad range for how the electron heat transport may scale relative to the Spitzer value in clusters. It could be reduced by a factor between 30 and 1,000. And that places you into one of the two possible sort of conclusions about the cooling flow model. Either it may hold in if you're at the high end of this reduction range, or there may be cooling that's at a reduced mass accretion rate. I should mention that there are some studies which find that this reduction factor is essentially one. There's very little reduction in some studies due to field line tangling. There are some studies which claim that if you start two field lines right next to each other, say you have an extended spectrum of turbulence extending from large-scale LB down to, say, the ion gyro radius, and you start two field lines that are separated by an ion gyro radius, if you move a distance along the field equal to LB, the two field lines will exponentiate apart. Actually, they'll do more than exponentiate. They'll reach a perpendicular displacement from one another equal to LB. So there's a huge shearing in the magnetic field lines. That's a minority of the studies of this problem at this point, but such studies exist. So to go beyond this, certainly we need to do a better job of determining LRR and get some of these numerical coefficients in front of this equation down better, perhaps with particle simulations of just tracing particle trajectories in one of some turbulent magnetic field. Also somehow getting more insight into the intermittency of the field strength in cluster turbulence will be critical if we're ever going to have a better idea of whether trapping plays a role in reducing thermal conduction. Oh, and one last thing I'll say in response to the first question about turbulent transport of heat. That's something I've ignored entirely in this discussion. It can be important, but at a lower level than the Spitzer value, because the Spitzer value is huge for clusters, because you have huge mean-free paths. And so the electrons move very fast into Spitzer conductivities, V thermal times lambda. And it can be huge. So the first thing you want to do is check what that is. If you have turbulent transport of heat, it proceeds at about a 40th of the rate of the Spitzer conductivity. If you take a simple estimate of V turbulent from line widths of optical filaments and a length scale of the turbulence of about 10 kiloparsecs, so it's still quite low. It may be reduced further by magnetic tension in some unknown way. I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes, certainly one could run sort of particle tracers for a given magnetic field configuration and calculate this diffusion coefficient directly. It's really complicated though, because part of the critical elements here are this LRR here, which depends very sensitively on your initial conditions, your boundary conditions. It's probably not a universal turbulent quantity, so it wouldn't be a simple matter, but that kind of thing should be done. Yeah. Actually, that's not correct. That is correct for the parallel diffusion coefficient. If you don't have very strong magnetic mirrors in a limit of small mean free path, you do recover that the parallel diffusion coefficient is like the Spitzer conductivity. But the three-dimensional diffusion coefficient is still reduced by this factor, even in the limit of small collisional mean free path. The electrons have to get off their initial field line, and it takes them a long parallel displacement to do so. Even in the limit that omega tau is less than 1. In that case, you would still have this problem. It would be with a slightly different value of LRR. You'd have slightly enhanced perpendicular diffusion local, like across the field locally, but local diffusion across the field doesn't get you off of your initial field line. You have to rely upon this divergence, exponential divergence of tangled field lines, so you still have to go a long distance along the field, even in that limit. In this presence of a tangled magnetic field, yes. And in general, the Spitzer conductivity, yeah, across the field is very small. Well, it's not the Spitzer conductivity across the field.
Separation scale for exponential, by the way.
Yes. That is I do that following a number of studies which find that to be the case for strong turbulence. It is not necessarily the case. Those two things can be different in either direction, in fact.
I just want to make a comment on the observation of the observational deduction of the scale length of the field fluctuations in storage. Those are based mainly on the fluctuation period of adjacent background sources and also the temporal sources. But extended radio sources intrinsically often have large carrier rotation within them. And I personally am not convinced that that when they ascribe these carrier rotation fluctuations to fluctuations in the cluster, I'm not convinced that that's correct.
That is especially, your comment is especially true if you look at maps such as this, where you're measuring Faraday rotation of a radio source in a cluster. However, you can also measure Faraday rotation along lines of sight far from the center of a cluster, and you still get Faraday rotation. Not of a radio source in the galaxy cluster, but of a background quasar, for example.
But in those cases, you don't see lots of variation in the sign.
But you do if you look at two different lines of sight. You can find two different lines of sight through a cluster that in the cluster would be separated by 10 kiloparsecs, and you get different signs. That kind of measurement is also done.
Yeah, so I think it's not going to look at your background sources themselves and intrinsic variation.
That's
you have to take account of that when you do these statistical studies. And I personally am not sure that that's been done.
Sufficiently accurately. One thing that does help you a little bit in this is that the rotation measures are huge, 10 to the 4 radians per meter squared, which for these clusters, because you just have so much gas, and that helps you rule out that these are, say, intrinsic to the source itself.